You are listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this episode is presented by me, Emma Louise Fenlon. Expert evidence at trial, one of the most thrilling and or nerve-wracking aspects of this job. In the third of what I will loosely call our LawPod series on expert evidence, I am delighted to welcome back John Whiting KC to offer the benefit of his decades of experience in high-stakes liability and quantum clinical negligence trials. Put simply, if John doesn't know it, it's not worth knowing in this field. John, you are very welcome back to the podcast. So to begin, what is the first thing that experts awaiting their day in court need to know about appearing at trial?
Well, given the title of this talk, I could tell you about the format of a trial, who does what and in what order and how long it all takes. But I thought our audience would probably know that anyway, and it would make for rather a dull half hour. So instead, I thought I'd tell you what a trial is not. It is not a friendly symposium of your peers at a medical conference, a collective and collaborative endeavor to reach a consensus, or an intellectually stimulating meeting of minds. Liability trials are binary. You win or you lose. They are all or nothing. And in the context of clinical negligence litigation, and particularly in the sort of cases which I litigate, claimant either leaves the building with the financial security to make the remainder of their lives at least bearable, or they do not. The defendant either loses 20, 30, 40 million pounds of NHS funds, or they do not. And for the lawyers, one side is on a CFA, and if they lose, they don't get paid for years of work. And on the other side, while the lawyers will get paid whatever the outcome, if they make a habit of losing, they will be unemployed. And almost by definition, by the time we're all standing there on day one of trial, the odds are even. It's a 50-50 gamble, and you're going to the casino and putting everything on red or black.
In that context, how does the combination of the high stakes you describe and the often tragic subject matter of the case affect things?
Emotions run very high at trial and tempers become frayed. I've seen counsel pinning their expert against the wall outside court and having an exceptionally frank exchange of views after they've fallen apart in the box under cross-examination. I have personally had an expert come up to me in the corridor after I had cross-examined them, jabbing me in the chest and hissing, "I am trying exceptionally hard to convince myself that you possess a decent bone in your entire body." And I've lost count of the number of times I've seen litigants storm out of court, screaming at their legal team, the court, me, or everyone. And equally, as an advocate, nothing will ever compare to the moment in a courtroom packed to overflowing, when at the culmination of hours of cross-examination, the opposing expert makes the concession that, in that instant, hands you victory. So that charged and febrile atmosphere is the context and the environment in which you play your part as an expert witness.
So how important is the role of expert evidence in clinical negligence trials specifically?
In clinical negligence, their role is pivotal. Occasionally, there is a factual dispute over, for instance, consent, but usually there is not. Very, very occasionally, there is a dispute as to the law, but almost always there is not. In the vast majority of cases, the outcome at trial will turn on the expert evidence, and more precisely, it'll turn on how that expert performs under cross-examination. And in that context, I'm always reminded of the words of the famous American jurist, John Henry Wigmore, who said this, "Cross-examination is beyond any doubt the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth. Cross-examination, not trial by jury, is the great and permanent contribution of the Anglo-American system of law to improved methods of trial procedure." And he was absolutely right. Without cross-examination and the cross-examination of experts, you could determine cases purely on paper. You could submit the written evidence and ask the judge to let you know their decision. What makes a trial is cross-examination. And more specifically in clinical negligence, the cross-examination of the expert witnesses. So the question as an expert you should be asking yourself is this: what is the expert trying to do, and how do you build your layers of insulation and defences against it?
Admittedly, telling us everything you've learned over the course of your career will take longer than the length of this podcast, but for those who are maybe newer to giving expert evidence at trial, What would you say are the headlines?
So I'd start by saying, always work on the premise that whatever you say, whatever you write, at whatever stage of the litigation, will someday be read aloud in court and be subject to minute scrutiny by your opposite number and by the opposing legal team and by the judge. Don't write something simply to please the client in the expectation that the case will settle and your opinion will never be tested. You do not want to be the expert who sits ashen-faced in the box, bitterly regretting their rose-tinted, crowd-pleasing, but ill-thought-through and partial report, written years before, knowing what is coming and being powerless to resist. And I'd also recommend that you take ownership of your work. Don't rely on the lawyers to point out mistakes, typos, or a failure to consider all of the evidence. It's your job. Complaining to the judge that others should have done your job for you is rather like the junior doctor whom you are taking to task for their mistake, blaming you for not teaching them well enough. And test your analysis and do it over and over again. It is a continual process. Be self-critical. When you're presented with an opposing or differing view, treat it with respect. If your opposite number has raised a good point in their report or referred to a piece of literature or some guidance which you hadn't considered before, give it careful, reflective thought and consider how you might counter it if you were presented with it in the box. Remember, you're an independent expert. It's so very easy to feel that you are part of a team, particularly as you approach trial, and that you're fighting to achieve a result for that team. If the other side does raise a valid point, or if the factual premise on which you'd been working changes, which in practice is not uncommon, then ask yourself fairly and independently if that changes your opinion. And if it does, then say so. It's a virtue, not a vice. As J.M. Keane said, when the facts change, I change my mind. It's so easy to get carried away just because you want your client to win or because you want to be on the winning side yourself, to stop being reflective and hypercritical of your own thought process and to stop giving impartial advice. Resist that temptation. It serves no one.
So let's assume you are an expert who wants to do their best for their client while also remaining as independent as they are required to do. Before they even appear at court, what does trial preparation look like? What sort of work is involved in making sure that what you are delivering is a high quality service?
So I'd start by saying, do your research. Don't sit back and assume your opinion, no matter how experienced or expert or distinguished you are in your field, is shared by everyone else. Ask yourself, what does NICE say? What does the Royal College say? What does the local policy say? And what does your unit's policy say? And also ask yourself, what have you ever said or written on this topic in a paper, in a seminar, or in a previous trial? You do not want to be standing there in the box, having that read back to you in open court, if you're now saying something completely different. And on causation, there are often highly complex issues or theories of pathophysiology to consider. So ask yourself, what's the latest research? Who's written what in the literature? Is it valid? Is it reliable? And for God's sake, if you are thinking of relying on it, read it through thoroughly first and make very sure it says what you think it does and that it supports the proposition that you say it does. That may sound obvious, but apparently from long experience, it isn't.
And so then coming to the trial itself, how ought experts to approach their day in court, possibly their days multiple in court?
So firstly, and this may sound simple, think about the optics. Start by not sitting next to the client, whether the defendant clinicians or the claimant or their family. Sit with your solicitor or the other experts or on your own. Don't give the appearance of partiality. Do make yourself available to the legal team. Don't turn up 5 minutes before the judge enters the room or rush off to clinic the second the judge rises. Your legal team may well need you, and certainly don't rely on the provisional timetable the parties may have agreed. Trial is unpredictable, and the chances of you only being required for the specific time frame allocated to you within that timetable are remote. And believe me, I have seen experts learn that lesson the hard way, and I can give a couple of examples of that. And with one, I was rather more sympathetic to the expert than the other. In one quite lengthy trial, one of my experts was due to give evidence on the Wednesday. Unfortunately, but predictably, the timetable overran, and it became apparent by that morning that he wouldn't be called until the following day and might not complete his evidence, in fact, until the Friday. Doubly unfortunately, he'd booked a surprise anniversary trip to Venice, leaving on the Thursday morning. So he spent all of the time that he should really have been spending with me, analysing his counterpart's evidence and strategising for his appearance in the court, frantically trying to rebook flights and hotels. And thankfully, given that he ended up taking her for a weekend at a competitively priced hotel in the New Forest instead, he was rather better in the box than he was as a holiday planner. In another trial where we were similarly overrunning, my expert was becoming even more frantic. In his case, however, as he confided to me out of earshot of my, in parenthesis, female solicitor, his concern was that if he didn't give his evidence soon, he'd be too late to get to the airport to meet his secretary, with whom he was hoping to spend an illicit weekend in New York. And you could certainly tell he was deeply motivated to leave the building as soon as possible when he gave his evidence, every monosyllabic answer being designed to end the ordeal as soon as humanly possible. Not someone, I have to say, with whom I ever worked again. So, when you're required to attend trial, assume you're in it for the long haul.
One of the things that may bother seasoned experts is the very real possibility that previous judgments involving their expertise, in which they may have been criticised, whether mildly or otherwise, can be brought up before the trial judge and put to them as an example of how they are in some way deficient as an expert. I imagine you've come across that many times before, but how would you recommend an expert approaches any kind of ad hominem attack?
When I'm giving talks to advocates about how to cross-examine an expert witness, one of the things we cover is ad hominem attacks and raising adverse judgments or adverse comments in previous cases. And the point I always make to them is that done badly, the expert will come out of it better than you will. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One is judges are, despite what one might think, predisposed to think favorably of experts who come and give of their time and of their expertise to the court and react generally quite poorly to ad hominem attacks which have no underlying substance. So bear that in mind. And secondly, I'd say this. No one, whether in the canon of Christianity or otherwise, is more welcome in the kingdom of heaven than the sinner who repents. It looks incredibly impressive if a judge has made a comment about you or about something you have done where you can demonstrate that you've reflected on it, you've taken it on board, and you have adjusted either your practice or your approach accordingly. Nobody likes someone who then goes and blames the judge or says the judge got it all wrong. Whatever you might think, what they do like is somebody who is reflective, as I've said before, and who is keen to give independent evidence, and who can demonstrate that they have taken steps to address whatever the specific problem is that they were criticized for. And often that is because they didn't take account of a specific piece of evidence or an opinion or something in the literature. And if they can demonstrate that either they've gone away and they've undertaken refresher training about giving expert evidence in court, or that they have been assiduous in this case not to make the same mistake again, it can actually turn very much to your benefit. So I think the key takeaway that I would recommend is if things have gone badly for you in a previous case, don't just dismiss it. Think about it. Raise it with your legal team in case they don't know about it and tell them what you have done to address the problem, why it arose in that case, why it hasn't arisen in this case.
For the less seasoned expert, I wondered how you approach an expert who is reluctant to offer an opinion at trial or leading up to trial in conference, in their report or otherwise. You and I will certainly have come across experiences of experts who want to leave everything to the court, who would rather sit on the fence, to use yet another metaphor, who refuse to nail their flag to the mast. And in those circumstances, it can mean that the other side gains an enormous advantage, even when your expert is ultimately superior So I wondered, what would you say in a situation like that to an expert who, for whatever reason, has formed the opinion that it's really not for them to give a final decision on whether or not, for example, care was proper or was non-negligent?
I think that is not uncommon for an expert to say, that's a matter for the judge or that's a matter for the court, where in fact, it's a matter of expert evidence. And I think what I always explain, and it does happen to me, what I always explain to an expert is that they are being asked for their opinion. And the area of expertise on which they are being asked for their opinion is not something which the judge shares. The court can make findings of fact, and that's its job, and it can adjudicate between different opinions, but it can't give an expert opinion on a particular issue. So I think from the lawyer's perspective, one should always make sure that the question one is asking of an expert is a matter of expert evidence and not a question of fact. You should always make sure if their opinion is predicated on factual issues, which are for the determination of the court, that they make that plain within their report and they set out the basis on which they are expressing their opinion, and that their opinion would change if the facts were found to be different. But otherwise, I think it's really a question of encouraging one's experts, as I would encourage them to do now within the context of this podcast, to have the courage of their own conviction. They are being asked for their opinion because they are experienced and they have expertise, and because that expertise and experience is valued not only by the legal team and by their client, but also by the court, and they should be encouraged to express it and not to hesitate to do so simply because there is a possibility that the court might prefer a different opinion.
One of the things I'm always keen to underline with first-time experts is to make them understand that when they are on the witness stand, it will be uncomfortable. And I think it's important that experts understand that this is not going to be pleasant as an experience for them. I wonder, what do you say to first-time experts who are about to appear in potentially a very high-stakes trial, like some of the trials you've described?
When you're in the box, it can be lonely and isolating. Your mutually supportive team has gone. You don't know how long you'll be there, what you will be asked, what rabbits are going to emerge from the hat, what the purpose of the various lines of questioning will be. And that's an unusual situation for eminent senior clinicians, experts in their field, to find themselves in. So, take a deep breath. Have confidence in your analysis, your expertise, your experience, and the preparation which you have done and the process which you have followed. Take each question as it comes. To use a cricket analogy, play each ball at a time and on its merits. Don't watch the clock. Don't worry about where it's all heading or what traps you think are being laid. Don't worry about how your answer might affect your client's case. And don't try and jump ahead to address the point you think this is all leading to. I do this for a living, and I never really know where my opponent is going with their questions or what point they're trying to make. Just listen to the question, think about it, and answer it as straightforwardly and as simply as you can. Do that, and you will avoid getting drawn into an argument. You'll give the appearance of cool, calm, informed impartiality, and you'll be able to keep going all day, and your voice will have authority. And finally, when you're giving evidence and explaining your thinking, remember your audience. The trial judge is not the oracle at Delphi. They are not one of your peers. They may never have heard a clinical negligence trial in their entire careers or have the slightest knowledge or grasp of medical issues. Bear that in mind. And when I'm asked by experts how to pitch their evidence to a judge, I'm reminded of something Jeremy Irons' character says in Margin Call, a wonderful film about the 2008 financial crash, where there's a scene in which the rocket scientist quant analyst is discovered that the entire basis on which the global financial system has been predicated is fundamentally flawed, is tasked with urgently explaining how and why that is to the old school CEO, Jeremy Irons, who has about as much grasp of complex financial instruments and trading algorithms as I do. And as he starts to do so, Irons stops him and says this, "And before I get into terrible trouble with any members of the bench who might be listening, the same most certainly applies when you're explaining anything of any complexity to a member of the bar. Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever. It wasn't brains that got me here, I can assure you of that. Work on that premise and you won't go too far wrong.